Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
All right, welcome to the Apparatus Architects live from the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland. It's Tom Shand and the slightly injured but very happy to be here, Michael K. Wilbur, Lieutenant Ladder Company 27. Mike, any words here for the audience before we introduce our panel today?
No, Tom, I think we ought to just get right at it. We have an excellent panel again, as always. I want to thank our panelists for devoting some of their time to answer some of today's most pertinent apparatus questions.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Okay. And for our listeners, our panel today, and I love to get this line in, right to left on your radio dial, we have Sean Duffy from Plastisol. We have Jason Whitmire, the pumper product manager from KME. We have Mr. Jim Sommy. These three gentlemen have been veterans at doing this. And we also are very fortunate to have Mike Dufresne from Pierce Manufacturing. Mike is the Midwest Regional Manager. While we're taping this down at Firehouse, right now, if we were to step outside, it's probably only a paltry 93 or 94 degrees, supposed to go up to about 99 with the heat index of 110 and plus. So, Mike, with that kind of heat index here, I'm guessing us engine company guys are still going to be in getting it. What are you ladder company guys going to be doing on a hot day like this?
Actually, you're just going to stand outside by the hydrant and get wet.
Okay, all right. All right, Mike. Well, we appreciate that. All right. So our first question here, and a lot of these were driven around some of the things that Mike and I have handled here in the last 5 to 6 months, and I think it's going to be indicative of where we're headed in the future with respect to the tight economic times here. But our first question to the panel, and we'll start out with Mike, and then we'll work across the dais here. Given the current economic conditions impacting the number of departments that have available funds to purchase apparatus, understanding there's a lot of departments that just aren't spending anything, there's no money for capital projects, what options or components do you see departments reevaluating in their efforts to include them in the specification requirements? So, Mike, what do you see in your area? And again, it's great that we got Mike here from the Midwest, give us a little different perspective sometimes from what Mr. Wilbur and I typically see out here where we're traipsing around the East.
Tom, what we're seeing is if the fire department, if they've got money to spend, they're going to buy what they want. If they don't get enough money, what we're seeing is that departments they're not going to spend the money unless they can really get the apparatus that they need. We've seen the trend over a number of years where because of NFPA, getting the type of apparatus that specifying the type that they need, a lot of people aren't going for all the glitz and glitter, you know, three-tone paint jobs and all that. So they're specifying basically a truck to meet their needs, and that's what we're seeing. If they don't have the money, they're not going to spend it to get something less.
Okay, Mike, that's interesting. When you mentioned about glitz and glitter and a basic unit, yesterday after we did some things up here, I traveled through southern part of Maryland to go take some pictures of apparatus, of specifically pumpers. So, Mike, you would have been bored out of your tree. But
right,
they had ladder trucks, Mike, but we were focusing on engines yesterday. And without any prompting, each of the people that I was talking to at these three stations in combination departments mentioned that we bought, in their world, what they thought was a back-to-basics unit. So that those engines, for example, didn't have hydraulic generators, light towers. I didn't see a foam system, and I know there's people that would debate that back and forth over, you know, whether you're foolish or not to put a foam system on, but these were engines, short wheelbase, had multiple pre-connected lines, and didn't have, you know, even if you take a generator, light tower, and a foam system, and the panel disagrees as we go through, you know, it's pretty easy to put those three things on a rig, and you run the cost up $40,000 or $50,000 at least. And sometimes people, they're looking and say, well, you got to have it on everything. But I think in some cases we've gone full cycle from if you had a department or an apparatus fleet, for example, that had a rescue truck, and the rescue truck had the big generator and a light tower and all the other stuff. People, once they started putting that even nominally on pumpers, they kind of convinced themselves, well, we got to have that on everything. And that's some of the things of what Mike and I are seeing, that in an effort to try to get the apparatus wrapped somewhere around where the municipality is telling the people, this is what we've got to spend. So if you're lucky enough, Mike, as you said, if you're lucky enough to have the money, guys, when you go into the auto mall, we got to have to keep it plus or minus a little bit, you know, one way or the other. Jim, what are you seeing in, you know, with your travels with Crimson?
I guess I'd differ a little bit. But I think there are about three categories right now. There's the category of people that want to buy what they want to buy, and they're going to wait. There's a category of people that are desperate to buy something because the apparatus has gotten to the point where they really can't function effectively with what they got. And I see a lot of those people struggling to come up with the money. And as a result, they've had to tone down their tastes a bit. And the third thing I see is a lot of people interested in buying stock trucks because they're concerned about losing their money. So if there's a stock truck that's relatively close to what they want or can be tailored as a truck to what their needs, that they're more willing to do that because they're fearful that they're just going to lose the funding entirely.
Jim, really good perspective there. Mike and I, with some of the work that we've done, and we've probably done more work trying to assist departments that are in the first category that you mentioned. One of the things that we've struggled with is when working with a department that in the past really was never given a budget. The apparatus committee was formed, whether it's a volunteer or a career organization. They developed the specifications, give them to the purchasing authority, they put them out to bid, and when the price came back, they got what they asked for. And the struggle that we have seen is with some of these committees where people are said, well, here's what we need to keep the unit in within budget-wise, where they haven't had that constraint. It's like we've been the reality check to say, you know, if somebody, for example, somebody's giving you $450,000, chances are you can't go out to buy a 10-person raised roof, 2,000 GPM with a 1,000-gallon water tank and put calves, light tower, and all this stuff on it. And while you could justify potentially any one of those components, it's incrementally running the price up. And the folks are somewhat unwilling to say, well, we can't do without it. And it's the reality check between here's how much money you've got in the checkbook. You know, if you've got $450,000 in the checkbook, you can't go out and buy a $465,000 fire truck. Now, Jason, you work in it with your capacity at KME with all different sizes of departments, I know, from large to small. You know, Have you had to have that experience, or where does the reality check come in? We're looking for some tips here, because I'm tired of getting beat up when we know that, you know, here's the people holding the purse strings on one side saying, hey, we're looking for your assistance here, and we wanted to keep the budget price here, and our fire apparatus committee is coming back and saying, you know, find the extra money because we can't do without.
Yeah, it's certainly been a struggle, and I think in previous years where we've had this podcast, we've talked about people evaluating what their core responsibilities are. And a fire company looking and saying, okay, so if I run 500 calls a year and I use my Class B foam system once, or maybe once every other year, then maybe I really don't need that system on the apparatus. And the problem is that these firefighters have been schooled over the years to prepare for everything. I mean, we're coming up on the anniversary of 9/11 here, and you'll have people say, well, we have to prepare for that kind of event. Well, in today's climate, with the money and the funding, you can't necessarily have every single widget on that truck that you would have in the past. So we see big ticket items like a big foam system. Maybe instead of having Class A and Class B foam, you just have one cell, but you have a system that if your priorities change down the road, you could bleed the A out of there, clean the system up, and put Class B foam into it if you have the right foam system. Things like that are happening more often.
Jason, is it true that the compressed air foam system represents one of the most expensive add-on components that there are to the truck?
Yeah, definitely. CAFS is a big investment, not only in cost, but in the company changing the way they operate. If you have a part that has multiple apparatus and you're going to put CAFS on only one unit, it changes the mindset of how that unit's going to operate. So you're talking the cost, the initial investment, the cost to maintain the system, and then the cost to train everybody on it. So that's something that has definitely taken a back seat in today's climate.
All right. Sean, your thoughts on this.
Kind of what Mike said. Away from the blame, as it were. And Jason was talking about phone systems and Mike saying CAS. We're seeing actually people that are actually taking an interest in high pressure foam systems that are part of a normal slash high pressure system that might not necessarily be class. But we're seeing that as an alternative to a costly CAS system. We're seeing fewer people that are actually asking for something as simple as a Q siren. just because of its cost. The other thing that we're seeing, and where there are a couple companies out there that are taking advantage of the fact that they can build a crew module at the front of a body, build a rescue body, a rescue pumper body, and use a commercial chassis, and potentially save that customer anywhere from $75,000 to $120,000 just on chassis cost alone. We're actually seeing people that are stepping away, at least in our world, stepping away from a commercial or from a custom chassis into a commercial just from a cost standpoint. They're able to maintain some of the more important things that they would like to have on their trucks, the widgets, the light towers, the maintain that Q siren or that foam system. So we're seeing a different direction. The things that Mike, Jim, and Jason have spoken about, we're seeing those too. But in our happy little world up there in New York, we're seeing a little bit different or a different angle of it, because we're seeing people that are actually taking a very hardcore look at, saving a dramatic amount of money just on chassis cost alone by having a crew module built in their body.
For all the panel, are you seeing an uptick in commercial versus custom?
We're not really seeing them. I think the FEMA numbers even show market share wise that people are better than Jim and Edgar. Well, the customs are pretty much equal to where they've been in the market.
Slight uptick on commercials, but not as dramatic as you might think. It's been running a 60-40 ratio, customs being 60%, and that ratio's crept up a little bit on the commercial side, but not dramatic.
Yeah, we haven't seen it, and we were quite surprised by it, because you would think in this economy, exactly what Sean said, you would think people would say, okay, I can get more apparatus if I go commercial because of the cost savings, but the customers that want a custom, what we're seeing is they'll wait until they have the money for the custom instead of going to the commercial.
Okay. Good. Our second question here, what cost consideration should fire department look at if they happen to find themselves in a position to reduce the acquisition cost of a new pumper? And I just threw down a couple of things of a medium block versus the big block engine with the attendant change in a transmission, program units, or the ability potentially to tag on to a customer that maybe already purchased units from one of the companies represented here, and gives you the ability to maybe make some minor tweaks and changes, but to kind of avoid the engineering costs to say we're starting out with a clean sheet of paper. So we'll kind of go in reverse order here, right to left. Sean, your thoughts there.
Well, one of the cost considerations that I'm seeing, and I have to take a lot of departments when I need to take into consideration, is do they actually really need all the things on the truck that they think they need? And I say that because when you look at the statistics of run calls, depending on geographically where you are. For example, I know in Ohio, which at least where I live in the Columbus, Ohio area, every department out there is a career department. 85-90% of what they run is EMS. So do they really need a $500,000-$550,000 pumper for something that, as Jason said, that once in a lifetime event that they're, they got to be prepared for all things? I think, maybe you should look at what your call volume is, what your run profile is, and build your apparatus around that, because I'm seeing more fire trucks in various parts of the country that are running more for EMS than fire, and they seem to be overloaded for fire for that event that might only happen once every 5 years. That being said, scaling down the size of trucks takes away a large block motor into a medium block motor, getting away from the equipment that you might not necessarily use in the life cycle of that truck. There are things that, if you evaluate what you're doing on a day-to-day basis and not preparing for, what may or may never come, and I know that sounds a little unusual for the fire services, I think if they take a harder look at what they're doing day-to-day, that they actually could reduce their costs on their trucks.
One of the things that Tom and I do as consultants when we have customers is, we want them to define the mission of the vehicle.
Right.
And knowing that you could design and build a pumper, ladder, tanker, foam, helicopter unit, if they have the money to pay for it, somebody would probably design it and build it. But the idea is to be definitive in exactly what the vehicle is going to be doing for the most part. Would you agree as a group that that's something that would be helpful to you as we as consultants are across the table from you, and so that we don't get these one-off, everything is supposed to be everything and it's really not good for anything.
No, I mean, it's very helpful if the customer can, like you said, define exactly what they need, take the unnecessary things off of it. And it's kind of funny, Tom, that you said you just threw a few things down here on paper. Well, you hit the major ones. I mean, those are the big things. The difference between a medium block and a large block engine is a lot of dollars when you consider...
Round numbers, Jason. Not that we're going to hold you to it, but just for the sense of the listeners.
I'll hold them to the number.
Okay, all right.
You're easily talking $10,000 to $15,000 till you consider the drivetrain, the transmission, and the engine itself. And then in many cases, I know all of us manufacturers have different levels of a chassis. Usually your entry-level chassis will only hold up to a certain engine. And a lot of times when you go to the big block, you got to get into that higher-level chassis. So if you're able to get into that medium block engine, you can save a lot of money on the chassis as well.
So you mean the engine has to do with the chassis, has to do with the transmission? It's not just about buying just a big engine.
It's about the HP number, is it?
No, it certainly is not. Jim?
Well, that's absolutely right. And when you look at the combinations, obviously what's going on with big block engines is heat rejection. All right, so what's happening is bigger cooling packages. You're basically consuming more space in the cab for the engine and the cooling package. So as a result, the cab has to be bigger. It's a different generation of cab potentially. And so as a result, you're paying a significant increase. I wouldn't be surprised if that number is more like $35,000 by the time you configure the vehicle around what we're talking about.
Yeah, good perspective, Jim. Mike, your thoughts?
Well, besides some of the things that we talked about, we are seeing a lot of departments that are looking at, you know, how can they hang on to an existing contract? That's something we added. You know, anytime you can get, you know, multiple departments to go on a bid from a manufacturing standpoint, we can offer discounts because of being able to, you know, you save on the engineering costs and being able to multiple types of units. We've also seen a lot of not just a tag on the existing contract, but fire departments actually getting together to do a group bid. So if we know there's three fire departments that are all kind of working separately, you know, we just get them together and say, you know, if we work together, you know, we can do a group bid and save everybody some money. So we're seeing more of that.
Yeah, and Mike, that's a really interesting perspective and something that Mike and I have seen, but it's really relegated to certain geographic areas where people can put that together, where you have independent companies, no matter what their funding stream is. Where Mike and I live in New York, I could take you to five adjacent fire stations, and the wheelbase alone, don't consider anything else, the wheelbase alone would range 30 or 35 inches based on somebody's perception over what we've got to do in the area. And it's one of the things that I would hope that sooner rather than later the economy is going to turn around so that the fire service in total doesn't have to change its mindset. But one of the things I find interesting, even from a deployment strategy, it's a number of years ago when the Phoenix Fire Department, when Alan Bruinsini was chief, developed a ladder tender concept of a two-piece ladder company, and where years ago people were used to running two-piece engine companies, and there still are some departments, Syracuse, New York is one that I'm very familiar with, that still, they a mini pumper, and that mini pumper has no firefighting capabilities of itself, but when the engine company gets an EMS call, they take the driver and the officer out on the mini and deliver the services and that, rather than rocking down a road with their $500,000, 2,000 GPM pumper that they need when they have a working fire. But that combined with some of the per mile costs, in some cases, Mike and I have gone and do work with folks, and it's happened probably more often than not where they say, this unit is the pride of the fleet. It's the one we take to the parades. It's the one we take the best care of. And we say, well, can we take a look at your maintenance records, or how much is it, you know, how much are you spending on maintenance? And when you get the totals of some of these things, you find out some of these rigs that everybody loves, it's the shop queen, and it's costing them $15,000 to $18,000 a year to keep a pumper on the street, and they wonder why they're constantly going over budget on maintenance. Well, that's, you know, if you, as to go to Sean's And Jim's point, if you're taking all this stuff A to Z of what you've got on the floor and say, I got to design a body to put it in there, you can do it, but it probably doesn't make sense, you know, to bring every tool in the toolbox to every incident that you might have in your community. Our next question was...
Tom, can I...
Sure, Jim.
One thing that I have seen a trend at, which is a trend that I haven't really seen much in the past, is especially in the major city environments, some of the more proactive departments are saying, let's think simplicity and total cost of ownership. All right? And so as a result, they're saying, okay, we are looking at the vehicle and what kind of serviceability issues exist. We are saying, are there technologies that we can apply to the vehicle to reduce operating costs? You know, so there are people that are looking at secondary power systems, idle reduction technology, so basically they get to the scene and rather than idling for 30 minutes while they find out that there's no event, they actually go to a secondary system or reduce the idle and reduce the power consumption. The nice thing about that type of a system is it also has a green flavor to it, because now you're consuming less fuel. You've got a message to your mayor saying, hey, we're green here, because we've never really talked about it in the fire service about being green much, you know. So now that you can actually tap into different funding streams as a result of that kind of approach.
Yeah, that we do that in the FDNY as it relates. We had a terrible issue with braking, and for years we had used Jake brakes, and then it was determined if we could put driveline retarders on them that it was a $10,000 add-on up front. But the bean counters back in financial said, well, if you spend the 10 grand up front by reducing brake downtime and parts, you can make that money back plus a lot more by just investing in the unit up front with some technologies or some better components. And then you get the green flavor, which is, like you said, you can tap into grants and all kinds of things with that that maybe makes a unit that might not have been affordable now can be affordable to that department.
And the other thing to consider, too, when you talk about green flavor, there is out there, with the U.S. Congress and Mayor, something called the Climate Protection Agreement. There's more than 300 cities and towns around the U.S. that have signed off on this agreement where their mayors or their city councils have approved them adhering to this agreement. And one of the things that's spelled out is that they will employ technologies that are green-friendly in all facets of their operation, whether it be in their buildings, whether it be in the way that they conduct business, you know, recycle paper, but also in their fleets. And if they have this, if they have signed this, it's really not a binding agreement, but most cities that have agreed to it are actually honoring all tenants of it. So if it's one of the cities that is, or the city that is looking to buy apparatus, it's a city that has a mayor that signed this agreement, they are more likely that if they have green technology on there, to actually get city council to actually advocate the funds for what they want to buy simply because they do have that green technology on there, like Jim said, idle reduction or, you know, secondary systems. If that's available on a truck, and I've seen this in a couple places, city councils are actually, or town councils are actually pretty big in saying, yeah, let's go ahead and do that because that allows us to, you know, showcase that we're doing something that is good for the environment. And I know of at least two towns in Pennsylvania that did that, and one town in Ohio that's done that. The fire department's got exactly what they wanted.
Our next one, we've got on our STEAM panel, we've got some pretty intelligent people. We've got a few engineers. We have no lawyers, so this is not designed. If you are F. Lee Bailey and listening to this program, please do not come back and sue these people. That's not the intent of the next question.
Remember, F. Lee Bailey was his part.
Okay, well... And Johnny Cochran is no longer with us. Moment of silence. Okay, back to the question, right? How does your company handle customer requests to waive specific NFPA 1901 requirements, such as, and I just picked these two because these are ones that committees have hit Mike and I with and said, oh, these people are going to waive this and we can do whatever we want. Top speed requirements as they relate to the GVW of the apparatus, and another one I picked was warning light certifications. We encountered one committee that this guy had memorized page for page the Federal Signal Code 3 and the Whalen catalog, and he had a lighting configuration that the good Lord himself couldn't figure out or certify. So not to put folks on a spot, but in general, Mike, what's Pierce's stance on this? If I'm in there doing a pre-construction conference, let's say on a pumper that weighs in excess of the gross vehicle weight capacity, where you're going to normally say, Tom, you're going to be speed limited to 60 miles an hour, and I'm telling you, Mike, my station dumps out on a four-lane highway, and you know I don't want to do 85, but I'd like to do 65 to 68 here, and I put in my specs because I was at least had half a brain. My tires are speed rated for 75. What are you or the folks at in Pierce going to tell me?
Well, what we do is right now we don't waive on any of the NFPA items, whether it's top speed, lighting, any of the NFPA requirements in there, we won't do it. You know, like if somebody wanted to let's make a light color change, probably NFPA compliant if they get home and they want to change the colors around. You know, that's up to the fire department.
But Mike, I'm going to buy 15 towers, and I don't want that.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
No. We're just taking that stand.
Okay, we're going to put Mr. Sami on the bench now here, swear him in, and understand, again, for the listeners that maybe haven't heard us before, Jim is a member of the 1901 committee, and again, not to make light of this, because Mr. Wilbur and I, we're all about safety. I mean, when it comes down to, you know, people can buy what they want. Some of the folks that we've advised, it's not the kind of, you know, engine or ladder that I'd want to have sitting in my fire station, but I'm never going to ride on it. It's not going to show up in my house, so, you know, you need to keep everybody happy. And as they say, sometimes the customer is always right, up to a point. Jim, your perspective on those things, again, specifically with respect to the top speed, because that's the one that we've gotten the most pushback from some people, and some of it's not legitimate because they've got road rockets that they want to keep going the same speed, and there are other cases where it may have some degree of legitimacy based on the size of their area and the kind of roads they have out there.
We've actually never waived on the speed requirement. I mean, as a manufacturer, one of the challenges obviously is when you waive on something like a top end speed and then the vehicle gets in an accident, you know, there's a very strict liability concern with that. So if you deem something to be really NFPA required and it's important from a safety perspective, then I think it's a very difficult thing for a manufacturer to waive on that type of requirement. I believe there's some things with NFPA that maybe have less safety to them that we would identify something they maybe would waive, but we would very, very difficult to document for the fire department to sign in terms of that waiver, because it really needs to give us some clarity as to our position.
All right, thanks, Jim. Jason, your perspective, what have you encountered?
Well, you're right. We see a lot of requests, and I know you do as a consultant, and I'd say that top speed, one of them. Warning lights we don't see as much as you would think, but chevrons are all over. I mean, every customer is questioning chevrons, and do I have to do this? And I don't want to become controversial and go against you, Mike, but I think your statement's a little wrong there as far as Pierce, because I believe from what I've seen from customers that have bought trucks in my area, you're doing the statement of exceptions and waiving certain things. But I think we're all trying to follow it the way that it's written to be intended. The statement of exceptions is not saying you don't have to be compliant on this item. The statement of exceptions is saying you, the end user, are going to take responsibility for making sure it's compliant before you put it into service. So, for instance, if someone comes into KME and says, I don't want red and yellow chevrons on the truck, my answer is going to be, I can't put red and white on there. I can't put blue and green on there, whatever you want. I can't do that. I can only put red and yellow on there. If you want to do it yourself, you can sign the statement of exceptions, but you're telling me that you're going to put red and yellow on there yourself. Now, I can't control what you actually put on there, but it's a statement of exceptions taking the liability off of me as the manufacturer and saying, you as the end user are going to do it. It's supposed to be something that you can reasonably change and do. Top speed's not one of them. I can't say, okay, I'm going to send it out at 75, and I know that when you get it, you're going to change it to 60. That doesn't work that way. Now, there's no easy way to fix that. The state of Pennsylvania has taken it a step further. The state of Pennsylvania has a 2% loan program for apparatus purchases. If you're going to take a 2% loan, you must certify that everything will be compliant when it's put in service. So if I have a statement of exceptions that says that you're going to do the chevron striping yourself, the state will call that end user and say, I need to know what company is doing the striping for you, and I want a letter from them saying that they are going to put red and yellow on there, or I'm not giving you your 2% loan.
Just for my own edification, is that what occurred previously with belting of personnel in baskets of towers before that interim amendment was passed? Was that that kind of statement where it was determined whether the end user would supply belting for the baskets or whether it would be the manufacturer?
I think in that case, Mike, it was the specifications did not require the belting to be installed by the manufacturer. So it showed up actually in 1500 as a requirement that occupants of the platform had to have the belt. So some manufacturers would supply the belts, several didn't because the fire department already had them.
Just before we go to showing the closed loop on that question, Jim, with your knowledge of the 1901 standard and not to put you on the spot, but the rebuilding standard, this was, again, just by the grace of God, had two departments back-to-back that had – one had never owned an aerial device, one that had owned an ex-FDNY rear mount ladder, are buying used platforms from different vendors, all right? And we happened to be working with one, and they're showing me all the new tools and equipment that they had purchased separately. And we're talking hand tools, saws, things that are going to go into compartments. So I queried them. I said, what about ladder belts? And the guy kind of looked at me and goes – hadn't thought about those. Said, well, did you have ones on the old rear mount? Yeah, but they're probably not too good. They showed me, and I'm like, they were probably older than I was. Is there a requirement now on these people that buy used vehicles, is there any safety measure built into the standard to ensure that somebody's going to supply these belts for these people, lest they get, you know, I don't see any difference between a new aerial device and a platform and an old one in terms of the level of protection these people should have. And if they never had one before, chances are nobody ever ran that one up the flagpole with them.
You bring up a really good point. If you look at from a pure standard perspective, 1901 applies to new vehicles. All right. So when we go into the used vehicle category, then or an upfitted unit, you know, refurb unit, then basically you go back and refer to the standard that was in place at the time of manufacture, and you bring it up a level or two. But since there's never really been a specific requirement in 01 to furnish those belts, it's not really 01 based, it's 1500 based that you should have life safety belts in the platform. So you could say that that's a universal application. Unfortunately, it's disconnected from the truck. So from that perspective, yeah, it's something as a manufacturer, somebody that's supplying that truck, you should strongly encourage. And when we would do that, we would basically, if you're doing that repair and overhaul, we would not be able to do the demonstration of the truck without safety belts. So you'd have those belts, and that becomes a logical point to explain what's going on.
Yeah, no, good point. All right, so we'll get back to Sean. Your thoughts on waiving any one of the NFPA requirements?
I mean, there are certain things that I agree everybody tries to get and does a very masterful job of meeting the intent of the standard, you know, at all possible turns. The thing is, speed, we haven't had that come up. But I think, you know, and there are a couple schools of thought. NFPA is not a law, but it is the recognized standard. I think that if we got into a situation where somebody were to say, hey, this is what we want to do, I think we would be agreeable to it, and we would be agreeable to it, provided that department solicitor or the city attorney indemnifies the company against that, and no attorney is going to do that. No attorney is going to sign an indemnification agreement absolving the manufacturer of any sin should there be an incident. So for us, we're just meeting the standard as best as we can, and to the intent that the standard's written. But that the speed thing really hasn't come up, and I know it's a huge item, especially out west on the big wide open roads, but
I have a spec right now from your great state of New York, where it's a tanker, and the customers clearly stated in the spec, we're going 65. And they've even written it and said, we know we're not allowed to go 65. We don't care. This truck must be specified to go 65. And we've kind of looked at it and said, what are we going to do with this? And in my opinion, from a legal standpoint, I'm going to bid it and say, no, you're going 60, or I'm going to throw it in the trash. And nobody wants to walk away from business in this economy. But one lawsuit wipes out over 10, 20, 30 trucks.
And I think that's one of the good things about this economy right now, that all of you as manufacturers are coming to realize there's some trucks that customers want that you just have to walk away from because the money that you're going to collect today is going to cost you thousands over the life of that truck, not only just for that truck, but in future business with other customers in that geographic area that get turned off. So
you got to remember, Mike, people are so desperate right now for business. There are manufacturers out there that are hurting, and they're going to take it no matter what. Today, if they're short-sighted, they don't realize what the long-term implication of that's going to be.
When you see the wording in this spec that I'm referring to, a manufacturer wrote it. I don't know which one wrote it, but it's not something that a call for a manufacturer wrote to say.
Probably somebody in this room.
Honestly, I don't, but it's out there, and there's no doubt. And what's a shame of all of it is I think a lot of us sitting here don't necessarily agree with the top speed requirements or with the limitations. We're not seeing firefighters die because the apparatus was on the interstate going 75. It's because they went into a turn that was 20 mile per hour rated at 50, and the top speed limitation doesn't prevent that.
Right. Good point. That's a good point.
If I may, Jim, I apologize for my ignorance on this, but how was that speed maximum established? Was it scientific data, or was it kind of like the Chevron situation where somebody just pushed and pushed and pushed for 13 years until he got his wife?
I think what you would.
I'm sorry, that was pretty bad.
This topic was debated endlessly. I mean, to the point of hardly could stand it. In the NFPA's 30 member committee, 10 from Fire Service, 10 from consultants and various independents, and 10 from manufacturers. By and large, most of the manufacturers were not in favor of it. It was largely driven by fire departments, and the fire departments were largely based in the east in high-density areas. All right? And so basically, it wasn't a huge problem for them because they have a lot of problem getting up to 65 or 60 miles an hour anyway. So I think that truly was a factor. And there were obviously tear-jerking stories about the tanker incidences and other problems that came out and came out repeatedly. The vote was very, very divided. I mean, it was, most of the time in NFPA type of votes on specific items, there'll be a vast majority in favor. In this case, it was literally a dead heat.
Jim, thank you. And again, for the listeners, understand that, when you're working with your committee, working with your committee in conjunction with a local sales representative from one of the manufacturers, you have an awful lot of choices, but when it gets down to safety-related items or the meeting the intent of the standard, that's unfortunately where the democratic process stops. The manufacturers need to follow the standard. The old adage has been in the past, if you don't like the standard, you maybe don't like the law that it was a 30-mile-hour speed limit in front of your house and you got nabbed for doing 37. Well, you don't like the law, change it. And the work that Mike and I have done in trying to counsel folks to at least try to keep them somewhere down the center line of the road, for the listeners with the four manufacturers represented here, there are some things that you're entitled to your opinion, but unfortunately that's the guideline and the regulation, and that's what we need to follow, that the stay in good stead.
A follow-up to the legal question, and not to put anybody on the spot, but it's one thing I think that's important to know, from your perspective. I know years ago that one of the most litigious things for manufacturers were slips and falls off of the apparatus. Can you each take a crack at that and just when it comes to liability issues for your particular manufacturing firms, what is the number one issue that your companies face to ward off potential liability? We'll start with Mike, please.
Well, probably one of the big ones that we've always, you know, struggled with is making sure you can meet all the step height requirements, because there's so many different ways you can get on top of an apparatus. So, you know, you start with one step, and you know, where do you end, and staying within all those requirements. That's always been something on our end that we've always, you know, trying to make sure that we can make safe.
Because slips and falls are,
yes,
are a huge issue.
Jim?
Well, when you look at product liability in general, slips, trips, and falls are a category, and it's the largest category of personal injury accidents that there is. And so as a result, there are a lot of very wealthy attorneys, because they represent people that have fallen off of vehicles or been involved, fallen off the curb, for God's sake. So I think there's a lot of attention that all manufacturers place on step spacing, step height, and I think we're all doing our best to comply with the standards, and many of us try to exceed the standards and have additional drop-down steps and additional things. But it certainly is one of the areas that's very, very important.
Jason, your thoughts on that?
Technology has improved as well. There's much better folding steps out there on the market now. Bigger surfaces, photoluminescent surfaces so that the end user can see it in the dark. Aggressive grip, stuff like that. It certainly helped to reduce some of that.
Sean, you mentioned, and this goes to Mike's point, because your company does a lot of work with commercial chassis, so you're inheriting a over-the-road truck design, so to speak, that may or may not meet the standard or be very firefighter-friendly. Your thoughts on that?
Well, we're making sure that the stepping surfaces and the tank covers are going over the doors into the cab themselves. I mean, we're actually fabricating to the standard to make sure that we're compliant with that. You know, step heights, and you know, you look at what's on the road now, especially with, you know, some of the chassis manufacturers, it's, you know, a tank, two straps holding it on, and a you know, two or three small steps. We're completely fabricating a slip resistant diamond plate cover. We actually may put the grip spray that we actually use on the top of our bodies. We're putting those on steps as well, just so, you know, just as an added measure of protection. But you know, it's really about it. I mean, everything else is step height. Yes.
Okay. All right. We're just going to wrap up here for our listeners with the last question. What upcoming NFPA 1901 standards, we're going to put on our little crystal ball hat here for a second, or EPA regulations are coming into play in the future? And if you have specific time frames for the folks on a panel, throw those out there, because the listeners are going to want to know, while if they are able to strike now and they have money and you just made a deposit into the fire department account in the checkbook and it's time to buy a fire truck, for those folks that were still somewhat reeling over the price impacts of the last round of combination of the EPA emissions and the 1901 changes, for the folks here, and we'll start out and change it up a little bit here. We'll start with Mr. Sami, since he's a sitting member on the 1901 committee. Jim, when's the next round of NFPA regulations on 1901 going to take effect, and is there anything that's being kicked around at the curb right now as to what people are talking about for things that might be coming down the road?
Interesting. Right now, 1906, the Wildland Apparatus Standard is just in its release cycle. And we've actually talked about the fact that there are many parallels between the standards. So we actually may slip a year on the 1901 standard and go to instead of a 5-year 2014 release, go to a 2015 release, so we can get the documents more in sync with one another. I don't think too many people would be upset with that.
The word devastated doesn't come to mind right now, Jim. Right. Right.
As far as I think what we've also seen in various task groups and discussions since the release of the standards was probably more backlash regarding some of the requirements than we'd seen in the past, and some of that ties back to our earlier discussions about where these is it necessary? And so I think there's some opportunity maybe a little bit at this next standard. I got to say, because you said I'm the NFPA guy several times, I can't speak for the NFPA. The other thing that I believe is going to happen is that the wildland and some of the interesting things that are happening in wildland are going to carry back a little bit in, because in the wildland standards, some of the things were eliminated. The VDR, some of the elements that came into 1901 were eliminated and were not included in 06 because of as a cost driver and the practicality of applying it to a commercial vehicle.
Okay. Mike, anything that you folks see in the horizon or something that you're planning and anticipating? Again, if people have money to spend within the next couple of years, you know, it's encouraging to hear Jim say that not only from a coordination standpoint between the 06 and the 01 standard, but that there might potentially be another year of relief before people have to worry about if they're going in front of their council or whomever, the budget drivers, to forecast what the rig's going to cost, that they don't find themselves a little bit short at the end of the meal when the bill gets presented.
We know there's some of the EPA changes on the greenhouse standards that's under review by Congress, but you know, right now it's too early to tell what that impact's going to be. And I know one of the things that there will be is more onboard diagnostics on the emissions end. But some of the standards that they're working on now, it's like I said, it's a little bit too early for us to tell exactly what that impact will be.
Okay, Jason, any thoughts on this?
Diagnostics in 2014, if I'm not mistaken, really shouldn't have the cost impact that we've seen in the last two revisions to the EPA standards. The biggest thing on NFPA is, and this is for all your listeners, to keep in mind that now is the time for them to be writing things in. If they go to the back of the NFPA book, it tells them exactly where and how to write in their comments. And now is the time to submit arguments on why they don't want certain things or why they think other things should change and become more strict.
Very, very good. All right. Well, we want to like to thank folks on the panel here for their time with a very busy time down here at the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore. So I'd like to thank Sean Duffy for his comments and very cutting insight on some subjects here. Jason Whitmire, Jim Salmi, and Mike Dufresne. Hey, we don't have to patronize anybody, all right? So signing off from Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects. We'll see you later, and be safe.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.